innocent, and the other, alas, is saying. So, welcome, Brother Mike.
Thank you very much. Well, it's certainly a joy to be here where the grass is green and the flowers are blooming, and it's not white snow to the horizon, which is what I left, and now I understand it's probably gray snow. I heard a few minutes ago that the volcano that's been erupting sporadically over the has finally dumped ash on the city of Anchorage, so I'm actually glad not to be home. It's one of those situations where you don't even want to go out and breathe the air. But it's wonderful to be here in South Carolina. It's really my first visit to this state. So what we're going to talk about, though, is first of all, the Alaskan saints, but more importantly, what they have to say to us about the continuing mission of the church in North America. And to begin with, you know, let me get my map. I realize that I talk about Alaska all the time as if everybody knew what we're... Actually, this was the crayons in the kindergarten classroom this afternoon. Most people would think that Alaska was found by Russians because, although you can't see it from your kitchen window, there's only 40 miles between the Chukotka Peninsula and St. Lawrence Island. And on a clear day, you really can see from St. Lawrence Island to the very tip of Siberia, the Chukotka Peninsula. But that's not where the Russians found Alaska. By the way, how did the Russians get all the way to Alaska? It's 12 time zones from St. Petersburg to where we're talking about. Anchorage and Moscow are on exactly opposite sides of the world. So how did these people from Europe wind up in North America? This was the last part of North America to be mapped. In the 17th century, everything was mapped, North America, South America, Africa, Asia, except this was blank, unknown territory. And so in 1728, Tsar Peter the Great commissioned a Danish naval officer, Vitus Bering, and a Russian naval officer, Alexei Chirikov, to haul all the lumber they would need to build boats, because there's no wood, there's no forest, there's no wood products at all within 100 miles of the ocean. To haul the supplies they would need to build some ships, to set sail, and their instructions were to sail along the coast until they came to North America. Every geographer in Europe posited the idea that if you sailed along the Asian coast, eventually you would come to North America. And in fact, you can. Bering sailed along the Asian coast. In the fog mist, St. Lawrence Island, so he didn't spot any part of Alaska that day, and sailed up into the Arctic Ocean here, having sailed right past. And he followed his instructions. He followed the land, but it turned out, if you follow the land, you wound up in the Arctic Ocean. It's water. So he turned around and went home and said, it's water, folks. It's not land. You can't follow the land to North America because there isn't any. Actually, there is. It's just 200 feet below water. The Bering Sea is only 200 feet deep. So the mistake was not that there was a land connection, but that there was more water on the planet than the Geography Society had calculated. That was the error. So according to propaganda, both then and now, Bering was sent back a second time in 1742, 13 years later, to do it again. According to our mythology, and we still teach this erroneously in our history books, both in Alaska and throughout the United States, Bering was sent back the second time to do it right. There was too much controversy about his findings. But in fact, on his second voyage with Alexei Chirikov and the two ships, the Pavel and the Petr, they sailed out to the tip of the Kamchatka Peninsula, which is down here. I didn't have enough paper for that. And they founded the town of Petr Pavlovsk, Peter and Paul, Kamchatsky. They waited for the winter to end, and they sailed out directly across the North Pacific Ocean. Bering discovered Alaska here. Now, either he was 3,000 miles off course, or he was up to something else. And precisely, we know, his instructions this time had nothing to do with sailing along the Arctic, on the Asian coast to come to America. They came with plaques, little brass plaques about half the size of these sheets of paper, and they were inscribed with a cross and the inscription, "This land is under Russian protection." In other words, in 1742, The Tsar was out to grab as big a chunk of North America as he could. And that's why Bering made landfall at a point where he could have hardly gone any further without running into North America. This straight line, this boundary of, that we have with Canada, was established on that day because Vitus Bering sighted Mount St. Elias, since it was the church holiday of the prophet Elijah. He saw the mountain 18,000 feet rising directly out of the Pacific Ocean. It's the tallest mountain in the world that goes from sea level to its peak. All the other high mountains are several miles high before you even get to the base. But Mount St. Elias starts from sea level and goes right up to 18,200 feet. He could clearly see it because that day it wasn't foggy. And he said, basically, I hereby draw a line from the tip of that mountain to the North Pole, and everything in the area behind me is now under Russian protection. Ilyich Chudikov and he were separated a few days earlier, and Chudikov actually got to Alaska one day earlier and made landfall way down here in this corner, which is why we have this green area, the Tlingit area. The rest of the world calls it the Northwest Coast. In Alaska, we call it Southeast. It all depends on your point of view. The southeastern part of Alaska would be part of Canada, except for Alexei Chudikov, who landed down here in this area, near what is the current city of Ketchikan, and put in his plaques. And then the British and Russian empires had to eventually establish, from mountain peak, the boundary that separates Alaska and the United States from Canada and British Columbia. Now, what was significant, Bering got sick and his ship wrecked in the Bering Sea. Chudikov got home to Petropavlovsk, all in one piece. Chudikov got here first and got home safely, and you never hear of him, right? Bering got here second and died and never got home, and he gets all the credit. I suspect this is sort of Anglo prejudice that Russians were too stupid to find Alaska. They had to hire a Dane. Because they always tell you that Bering was a Dane in the service of the Russian Tsar, but in fact it was the Russian explorer, Alexei Chudikov, who got here first and got home. And then they sent out search parties to find Bering and his crew, and they didn't. But Bering's crew was smart enough to build a new ship out of the wreckage of their old one, and they also, most of them, survived and made it home. The importance of this is that when the Bering men got home with walrus tusks, walrus ivory, which was of course valuable, they also set off a fur rush among the Chinese because they brought with them for the first time sea otter pelts. We say, so what? We have Eddie Bauer. We don't need the furs. But in those days, fur was an absolute essential just for getting through the winter. The Russians had plenty of furs. They had foxes and beavers and martens and all the rest, mink. But the Chinese had none. So their demand was for Russian furs. And sea otters, by their name you can guess, live at sea. No matter how cold the ocean gets, their fur is the densest fur of any mammal, and it's softer than mink. So extremely soft and so dense that it's virtually waterproof made sea otter pelts the most desired fur probably in the world. The Chinese were willing to pay $10,000 to $15,000 for a pelt. The cash registers were going off all over Siberia. We've had gold rushes in American history. The Bering expedition survivors set off a Russian fur rush. The problem being how to get there. There's no wood on the coast. The frontiersmen from Siberia could rush off to the beach and then find nothing to build a boat out of, except they shot elk and deer and made leather boats. They sewed them together. It was like rub-a-dub-dub, six men in a tub. They launched out in leather boats that probably, well, they would certainly be smaller, probably from the middle of the church to the door, maybe 20 feet long. Can you imagine six guys in a leather boat sewn together by their own craftsmanship and launching out in a boat that size, and they had to put all their supplies, because they had to eat, and they had to hope that the Japanese current would wash them somehow into the Aleutian Islands. And 80% succeeded. Against all odds, 80% of them, 4 out of 5, of course 1 out of 5 sank. But 4 out of 5 isn't bad considering how primitive these crafts were and how inexperienced their occupants were, because these were frontiersmen, mountain men, If you're old enough to remember or have seen the videotape of the film Jeremiah Johnson, you have some idea of the kind of lifestyle these frontiersmen were living. They were inveterate bachelors. They each one had to have their own little homestead or cabin. They set up their trap lines, they fished, they hunted, and to make any money, if they needed any money, they cashed in their furs for some cash, and then they bought their supplies, their ammunition, their gunpowder, their tea, their flour, and probably their whiskey. That was their lifestyle. Well, these guys in these tubs washed ashore in the Aleutian Islands year after year. 5, 6, 7 of them. They were rather poorly equipped. In our American histories, we say that it was a kind of military invasion, but it was absolutely no such thing. They came in very small numbers. They had very few weapons. They were basically traders, salesmen. It was like the Amway agent coming to town. This was not Jesse James coming to rob the natives. If they had weapons, don't forget this is the early 1700s. Remember the kind of gun ammunition, the kind of technology people had during the Revolutionary War? You had to keep your powder dry. In this area, that's nearly impossible. And it took you quite a while to reload. So in our American histories of this period, and it's very poorly researched, the story is that the Russians came in almost like pirates, you know, with their pistols blazing, and robbed the people of all their furs. It's really completely illogical and in fact, unbelievable. Because a few men with a couple, they had swords. Some of them had spears or pikes. They had very few muskets. And the muskets, being outnumbered at least 200-1, would not have been a major military advantage. You might get off one shot, but you'd look like a porcupine before you got the second one on. So these men actually were out there trading with these Unangan or Aleut people. I think I put the color there to make them sort of orangey yellow. This area, the people in this region call themselves in their own language Unangan, which means we the people. Sort of like the beginning of the American Constitution. We the people, Unangan. The Unangan welcomed them because they actually had a word for iron. I suspect some Chinese sailors had washed ashore with nails or axes or knives of some sort. And so in their own language, they had a word for iron that comes from Chinese. So that's the evidence. They knew what iron was, they just didn't have any in their region. So they knew what they wanted. But as it turned out, as more and more of these expeditions, 5, 6, 7 guys in a leather boat, came ashore, they discovered very early on that the Unangan valued more than anything else blue glass beads. Forget the tea kettles, forget the axes, forget the blankets and the buckets, just bring a pocket full of beads. So people could come with 20 beads in their pocket, go home with 20 pelts. 20 pelts was like 20 years' income. Logically, you'd retire after that, right? None of them did. They'd get to the Aleutian Islands, it would take them, they'd have to go to Petropavlovsk, stop there for the winter, launch out to the Aleutian Islands, do their trading, get back, if they were lucky, to Petropavlovsk, then get to the mainland, and then it was 1,000 miles deeper into Siberia to get to Irkutsk and Kiakhta, where the fur trade was conducted. So it was about 3 to 5 years round trip. They made a fortune. Imagine, 20 pelts, 20 times 20, 400,000. And life expectancy was shorter. They were already 25. They only expect to live to 40. Obviously, if you had that much money, you'd retire too. But none of them did. What did they do with all that money? They gave it away. They endowed monasteries, churches, schools, and hospitals. Irkutsk, the city where the fur trade was conducted, flourished during this period. And then, they could only give so much away to charitable enterprises. They partied with the rest. They squandered it, just like gold rush prospectors do. Wherever there's a gold rush, there's a tavern. And so they had a hot time in Irkutsk for a couple of years, probably. And when they went broke and had squandered their fortune, they did it again. I think the record is 7 times. Now it's 3 to 5 years. Somebody spent 30 years of their adult life going back and forth to Alaska. Greed does not explain this behavior. If they wanted to settle down as millionaires, they could have bought themselves a mansion in Irkutsk and hired a butler and had tea served at tea time every afternoon. These guys weren't about to do that. They were allergic to starch white shirts. They didn't want to settle down in the city with a mansion and, you know, all the elegance and all the luxuries that their fortunes. They threw it away. And they went back again and again because that was their lifestyle. They just loved doing it. And some of them, after their second and third voyage to the Aleutian Islands, just settled there. They probably had their eye on this Unangan cutie, the last two visits. And they brought an extra pocket of blue beads for her papa. And they said, we'll give you all of these if you let me marry your daughter. And those kind of deals were struck. In fact, when Father Makari, Hiram Makari from Valam, came to the Aleutian Islands in 1795, he was quite disappointed. He had no one to baptize. The entire Unangan tribe had been baptized by the Kromishaniki, by these frontiersmen who had not only traded with these people, but introduced Christianity and intermarried with them. And after 50 years, the Unangan were already Christian. Now, you might not, probably from here especially, you wouldn't consider settling permanently in the Aleutian Islands. It rains horizontally. It's windy, it's damp, and it's cold. But you have to remember, these Premishaniki came from Siberia, where it was 20, 30, 40 below zero for months at a time. So the Aleutian Islands were the closest thing to Tahiti they had ever seen. They loved the place, and they loved the people. And when it was Christmas, they sang Christmas carols. And it was Pascha, they sang Christ is Risen. It's normal, it's logical. It wasn't a mission in a planned, organized sense, but it was highly successful. Now, I mentioned this even before we get to St. Hermann and St. Innocent and the other saints, because I think there's an important lesson here. And we'll pause periodically during this talk to point out these lessons. What's the lesson of this 50-year fur rush? I think it's important for us to remember, mission is primarily the task and responsibility of the laity. I'll repeat that. Mission is essentially and primarily a lay task. Why? Well, just put it this way. If your pastor spent 90% of his time visiting people who weren't your parish members, you'd be upset with him. Father, we pay you to be our pastor. You better be there when I call. Don't hang out at the tavern with those pagans who need conversion. I've had a few priests in Alaska who have done that. I'm just converting them, honest. No, you see, the priest has to attend to the spiritual needs of his flock. It's the responsibility of the laity. I'm not suggesting that we train everybody to go door to door with leaflets. No, that's not what I mean. What I am suggesting is that I'm not even suggesting that we go out and talk about our faith and witness. I'm not suggesting that either. But we inevitably meet people, if we're at all sincere in practicing our own faith, who will notice that and inquire. You don't have to be an expert in everything Orthodox. By the way, nobody is. You just have to say, well, this is my experience. I'm willing to share it with you. Come and see. Once they come and see, Father will take them over. But to bring them to church, and statistically, sociologically, this is what all the studies say. People join churches because they were invited. People become members of congregations and convert to various religious traditions because someone they knew and trusted and respected invited them to. And you see what I'm saying? That's the job of the laity, because they're out there rubbing shoulders with people who are seeking, who are maybe even lost, disoriented, confused. And they say, you're grounded in some tradition. What's that? I can't explain it to you. Because, you know, frankly, in Orthodoxy, we can never explain it to you. In the end, our faith is based on the experience we have in the church, but we can't put it into words. So the best thing we can do is to say to somebody, come and see for yourself. And then, if it's God's will, whatever. But mission is a lay responsibility. And if the laity took that responsibility seriously, well, we wouldn't have to be talking about the budget, how we're going to pay the bills. You know what I'm saying? All our problems, because the church will continue to grow exponentially. Because if everybody brought one more member to the church every year, we would double every year. And you wouldn't consider building a church only twice as big as this one. You'd have to plan ahead. Because by the time you built one twice as big as this one, logically, it'd be way too small. That's the mission of the church, but it's the mission the laity have to. And that's where we started in North America. The clergy came later, and everybody was already baptized. Now, how did the clergy come? Chapter 2. This fur trade was rather wasteful. The investors, the bankers, the businessmen of Irkutsk, they were making money secondarily on the fur trade, selling goods to the men who were coming through with all these hundreds of thousands of dollars. But Rebbe Shelikov, one of these investors, said, you know, I'm kind of tired of investing in somebody else's fortune and watching them come home and throw it away. I'm going to get involved in this fur trade myself. Now, he knew nothing about fur and nothing about trade, but he went to the bankers of Irkutsk and he said, let's build some boats. Not wooden leather, not leather tubs. Let's build some ships. Let's bring the lumber out to Petropavlovsk and knock together some real vessels and bring boatloads of fur home. Why nickel and dime this? And he got enough money from the Golikov family and his own bankers to outfit three boats. They were named after, typically, the Simeon and Anna, the Archangel Michael, and the three hierarchs. These are the great Rebbe, the theologian, and John Chrysostom. Very Orthodox boats. But Shelikov's plan was not to continue the trade. Shelikov's plan was to extort furs. He wasn't going to bring beads or blankets or buckets. He was going to bring cannon. And the plan was to mount these cannon on smaller boats and point them at villages. Not with the idea of killing the natives. That would have been counterproductive. He still needed those native Alaskans to go out in their kayaks to harvest the sea otters. It's pretty hard to maneuver a kayak and throw a spear, let alone to hit anything that's moving. The Unangan could do that. The Kodiak Alutiks here on this, what do they call it, sort of pinkish island, they were adept at that. And that's where Shelikov was going to go because he figured the Aleutian Islands, that had already been depleted. So he was going to head for Kodiak, and the Kodiak people didn't want any Russians there. They chased them away every time they came close. So he was going to go there with cannon, and he was going to point the cannon at a village, making a threat. I need a quota, so many hundreds of sea otter pelts by the end of the week. If I don't get them, I'm going to blow up your smokehouse with the 300 smoked fish in it that you'll depend on to get through the winter. So you're not going to die because I blew up your salmon supply, but it's not going to be a very pleasant winter for you, your wife, and your children. And that was enough to convince the Kodiak people to go hunting for Rebbe Shelikov and his men. So they set sail from Russia. They landed in Onalaska, in the Unangan territory, and he ransomed a Kodiak man who had been taken like a POW, captured in some conflict between the Kodiak Aleuts and the Unangan Aleuts. And this man was therefore very much indebted to Rebbe Shelikov for ransoming him. Rebbe wanted him, though, as a translator. Go to your own people and tell them the deal. I've come in peace. I just want them to settle next to me, thinking that his 200 guys would intermarry with 200 of them, and the same thing that had happened in the Aleutian Islands would be expedited on Kodiak Island, but the Kodiak people weren't interested. They said, go away. They sent this ambassador back a second time, go away, and if you come back a third time, we'll kill you. So this POW went to Shelikov and said, they're refusing. Shelikov said, okay, where are they holding up? And they were held up on a promontory, a peninsula, that at high tide becomes an island, but at low tide is a peninsula. And this betrayal, this collaborator, brought Shelikov and his four cannon behind this stronghold, and they shot their cannon into this small settlement. And it created a panic, and about 200 people died. And they, okay, we surrender, we'll do what you ask. And that's how Shelikov conquered Kodiak. And then he turned around and went back to Russia. He went all the way to St. Petersburg, where he'd never been, and presented himself to Empress Catherine the Great. He claimed, as in typical Shelikov fashion, Rebbe Shelikov was a rogue, but he exaggerated everything he did so much that when you read his accounts of his own exploits, you laugh out loud. There were 200 people at Refuge Rock. He claimed before Catherine the Great he had conquered 10,000 people. Not only that, but he had introduced Christianity, preached the gospel to these people, and built a church. None of which was true, by the way. And for all of this, because he did it out of pure patriotic devotion, right? He deserved to be knighted. He wanted to be Sir Gregory. He also wanted a government subsidy of a couple $100,000 to continue his operation. And he wanted a monopoly of the fur trade. He wanted all those permits to be put out of business. He wanted to have sole control of the fur trade, not only for Alaska, but Japan, Korea, and the Philippines while he was there. See what I say? There was nothing bashful about Gregory Shelikov. Empress Catherine the Great, however, was reading laissez-faire economics. She was up to date. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations had already been published. Monopolies were not in vogue. So she denied his petition. She gave him a little nettle. Good work, Gregory. I'm so glad you're so patriotic. Now go back to Alaska and take care of things. But Shelikov was rather reluctant to be dismissed unfortunately, so without getting anything he had asked. So he went to Her Majesty a second time. "I'm willing," he said, "to subsidize a mission if you'll only give me permission to take a priest with me as I go back. Because those people on Kodiak Island are thirsting for the gospel." She said, "Fine, but you told me you conquered 10,000. One priest would be overworked. I give you permission to take 10 clergy at your expense." You can imagine how happy Gregory was. He had promised to provide transportation for these volunteers. So he went to Valong Monastery on the shores of Lake Ladoga, the largest lake in Europe. And he did get his 10 volunteers. And he did prepare them for the trip. He did provide transportation of sorts. He bought them new boots. And they walked 8,000 miles across Russia. The longest missionary journey in the history of the Orthodox Church, and maybe in the world. 8,000 miles. And they sailed on one of Shelikov's boats to Kodiak, where they arrived September 24th, 1794. This is the date we celebrated as the bicentennial of our church. September 24th, 1794, our bicentennial back in 1994. It's when Patriarch Alexei came. He came in 93 sort of to kick off the bicentennial year. And the monks went into culture shock as soon as they arrived. It was nothing like Shelikov had described. He said there was a church, there was no church. He said he converted some of the natives, there weren't any such converts. And they saw instead this extortion that was going on. So within a few months, the Valong monks blew the whistle on the whole operation. They wrote letters back, unfortunately, to Shelikov. Because Shelikov had completely fooled them. They said, "You know, now that we come to Kodiak, and it takes a lot for the boots, now that we come to Kodiak, it's nothing like you described to us. It must be this manager that you appointed. Alexander Baranov, your manager, is not doing what you told us should be done." It turns out Baranov was doing exactly what Shelikov wanted him to do. But the monks wrote to Shelikov and said, "You've got to do something about this, because these are all these things that are going wrong. These native people are being exploited. Their labor is being... People are dying because they go out hunting in desperation to get the pelts to fill their quota. And there's a storm comes and 100 kayaks over are capsized. We're witnessing the depletion of this population. It's completely oppressive and unjust. And we really should report this to the government. But we don't want to get you in trouble, Gregory, our dear friend." And so in 1795 already, the monks are writing this way. Of course, Shelikov doesn't reply because he knows exactly what's going on in Kodiak. So they begin writing letters to the church authorities. And the head of this mission, Father Yosef, is summoned to Irkutsk, where they ordain him in 1798, Bishop of Kodiak, a higher socio-political rank than Baranov or anybody else in Kodiak. In other words, As Bishop of Kodiak, Father Yosef, Bishop Yosef, could have arrested Baranov and sent him back to Russia. But the ship bringing the new bishop back to Alaska sank in a storm. And the Baranov regime lasted 19 more years. And this is why Father Herman left Kodiak. He was the old, he was the senior monk. He wasn't ordained, he wasn't a priest. But he, after a while, he was like the only one left. Because everybody either died or went back to Russia. He was one of the few remaining in Kodiak, and there were 3 assassination attempts on his life. The monks had already been under house arrest for over a year. And so people were just giving up and going home. Father Herman could have gone home too. When we sing his Akathis or any of the liturgical hymns to honor him on his feast day, it's rather deceiving, I think. Because we honor him as a prayerful, pious monastic, the founder of monasticism in North America. He is that. But he wasn't that venerated by the Aleut people because he said his prayers and kept the fasts. He's venerated as a saint for them because he continued to appeal on their behalf for redress at great personal risk. He didn't move to Spruce Island to get away from the crowd. Kodiak wasn't that crowded. It just wasn't safe. He had to get out of harm's way. And he moved to the place now called Monk's Lagoon, where he not only continued his monastic life, if that's what he wanted, he could have gone back to Valam. But he remained in Alaska for 40 years, constantly writing appeals for the civil authorities to investigate and to put an end to the exploitation and oppression of the local people whom he had come to evangelize. Now, by the way, this mission was, from the church's perspective, a tremendous success. Over 7,000 people were baptized in the first years of this mission. But the priests soon were all gone. Yosef took with him 3 or 4 of the monks who also drowned when his ship sank. Father Ivanali, whom unfortunately we won't have much time for, was martyred in this area, in the southwestern Alaska, actually here on the shores of the Bering Sea. He approached a hunting party there, trying to evangelize them in an angyatjaw, that's the Yupik word, a little boat. It's significant because it's not a kayak, a Yupik boat. He was in because he had traveled the entire southern coast of Alaska and come out on the Bering Sea, as he intended. It's what he said he was going to do when he left Kodiak. When he got out there, he was in a boat that was not Yupik. He had picked up someone along here who had offered to show him, guide him the way westward, and this man was helping to row the boat as they approached this Yupik Eskimo hunting party. And the shaman was among them. And the shaman told the other hunters, I don't know what kind of gesture you make to go away, probably, you know. Make some sort of gesture to make them back off. They did whatever the gestures they made. Either they didn't understand it, or they decided to proceed anyway. So this Angiachok, this little boat, with Father Ivanali in the bow and the other man helping to row in the back, continued to approach this hunting party. The shaman then told the hunters, kill it. And in a hail of arrows, they killed the priest. He fell into the boat. The helper, the guide, then tried to escape. He jumped overboard and tried to swim across the bay. Now, Yupik Eskimos don't swim. They believe getting wet will kill you. And of course, if you live in that part of the world, you'd probably agree. Hypothermia is the real danger. So they had to get into their kayaks and chase this poor man down, and they eventually killed him as well. Then they pulled the boat ashore with Father Uvanali's body in it, and the shaman removed from his body his pectoral cross, a brass pectoral cross and chain. And the shaman put it on himself. And he tried to do some kind of magic, some kind of seance or ceremony, but it didn't work. As he sat there, he felt himself instead being lifted, levitated, and it startled him. He tried a second time, and the same thing happened. The third time, he took the cross off, tossed it aside, and said to whoever he threw it to, be careful with this, there's some power here I can't deal with. That's the Yupik oral tradition that's circulated for 200 years in this sort of light blue area of southwestern Alaska. It's where my wife is from, and my father-in-law is the one who told me this story. I kind of dismissed it. They didn't use the word Father Juvenali, they said the first priest. And I know the first priest to visit this area, Father Yaakov Netzviatov, didn't come till 1842, and he died in retirement down here in the Panhandle, in Sitka, in 1862. He wasn't killed by the natives. So this story didn't compute with me until I realized they were talking about Father Juvenali 50 years earlier. The evidence that the oral tradition is accurate comes from the Moravian Church archives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The Moravian Christians were given this blue area as their mission territory by the federal government of the United States in the 1880s. And the first missionary teacher to head out to this area, John Kilbuck, records in his journey 100 years later, 1890s instead of 1790s. Apparently, I'm not the first missionary to come here. It seems there was a Russian priest who came along this shore in a little boat. And he met a shaman and a hunting party, and he was killed in a hail of arrows. And the servant, he called him, his assistant, tried to swim across the bay. They say he swam like a seal. And the Yupik hunters had to hunt him down. It's the same story. I heard it in 1995. The event happened in 1795, and in 1895, right in the middle, John Kilbuck heard it too and wrote it down. It's the same story for 200 years. Every missionary in this area who visited the village, Quinahock, testifies that that's the place where Father Juvenali died. So I think we can say with some confidence, Father Juvenali died as we've described it, but then why? Two guys in a wooden boat paddling along the shore, obviously not armed. The hunting party had plenty of weapons. Why did they have to kill him? Why were they so afraid? And the answer comes from an exhibit at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. There, among the collection of Eskimo artifacts, are ivory chains carved from walrus ivory. And the display says, for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, Alaskan shamans carved such ivory chains in imitation of Siberian shamans who wore metal chains. So it seems to me reasonable to conclude those hunters believed Father Juvenali was an alien intruding shaman from the opposite shore. And the only way you can protect yourself from the magic or the powers of such a person is to keep them a safe distance away. And if that doesn't work, your only protection is to kill them. So when we commemorate Father Juvenali, one of the other 10 recruits who walked across Siberia, we should always remember as well his companion. Hieromonk Juvenali and his companion. They're the first martyrs, even before Peter the Alley. The first martyrs who suffered and died for the faith are Father Juvenali and his companion, who died on the shores of the Bering Sea at the village of Quinahock. I realize most people won't remember Quinahock, so we just say Juvenali and his companion, because that companion had to be someone who baptized in the other regions. We can deduce this because if the man were Yupik, first of all, he probably wouldn't be able to swim. But more importantly, he would have been able to shout to the men on the shore, "Hey, friends, I'm your relative, don't shoot." Obviously, he couldn't communicate with them. And the final evidence to this is in this orange area. The people here along the shores of Cook Inlet, in the orange area, they swim. They swim to this day. They swim in the North Pacific Ocean. So I'm just connecting the dots and saying, I believe Father Juvenali's companion was an Athabascan Indian. The Athabascans are a very large group. They occupy the interior of Alaska and the northwest quadrant of Canada. And there are two Athabascan groups in the United States, besides Alaska, the Navajo and the Apache. These are obviously Athabascan people, Alaskan people, who couldn't hack it and moved south. But in any case, they're a completely different language, culture, and tribe, and yet they're the swimmers. And we want to give credit that among our martyrs is an Athabascan Native American. Maybe someday that'll give us the in with the Apaches and the Navajo to make Orthodox Christians of them. Because our first martyr was Athabascan, along with Father Juvenali. Well, back to Father Herbert. He spent 40 years appealing for redress. And in 1818, when Alexander Baranov was finally retired, his replacement, Semyon Yanovsky, went straight to Spruce Island to basically say, what in God's name has been going on here for the last 30 years? Father Hermann, thousands of people have been impressed into company service because Baranov established trading posts in the Kuril Islands south of the Kamchatka Peninsula, just north of Hokkaido, Japan. There were Kodiak Aleuts, hundreds of them, forced to man a trading post in Urop Island in the Kurils. The Cook Inlet area was trading post manned by Kodiak Aleuts. The Pribilof Islands out here in the Bering Sea were also a sealing operation conducted by Kodiak Aleuts. Sitka had 500, over 1,000 kayaks in the battle of with the Tlingits in 1804, and most of them were Kodiak Aleuts. Fort Ross, California had 200 Kodiak Aleuts. There weren't that many Russians. First of all, the people we call Russians were Siberians who had intermarried with Siberian natives. So the so-called Russians who came to Alaska probably weren't Slavic at all. And if they were, only a tiny minority. Because the frontiersmen, like Jeremiah Johnson, if they married at all, married local tribal women, just as the Premier Schlenicki had in the Aleutian Islands. So there was this tremendous cultural and racial and linguistic mixing going across Siberia, into the Aleutian Islands, and finally in Kodiak and Southeast Alaska. So when we say Russians, first of all, it's kind of a, they weren't blonde, blue-eyed Viking types, for one thing. They were citizens of the Russian Empire. But also they were forbidden to settle in Alaska unless they married. And while many of them did, those who didn't were on a 7-year contract the way men might work in the oil fields today up here in Prudhoe Bay. Nowadays, because of jet service, you sign up to work for a year, and it's 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. And they fly you up, and you work 2 weeks, pretty much around the clock, and you get exhausted, but then you have 2 weeks off, and you go home. And then after 2 weeks, they bring you back. 2 weeks, 2 weeks. That would have been totally impractical in the 1800s. It took a year to get here. So people signed 7-year contracts. But when your 7-year contract was finished, when it was over, when it expired, you had to go home. You weren't allowed to stay. This was not Jamestown. This was not Plymouth Rock. It wasn't a colony in the Anglo sense. You were working for the company, the Russian-American company. They hired you to do a job for so many years, and when your contract expired, you went home. So who was going to do all the work? Because at any one time, the company only had 800 employees. The people who actually signed contracts and were working in Alaska, 4 time zones wide, and in that huge territory, at the height of the Russian occupation, there were 800 or less employees under contract. So this was not Massachusetts, Carolina, Georgia, Maryland kind of colony. You went there to work for the company, and then you went home. Only those who stayed were allowed to, who married were allowed to stay. So Father Hermann tells Father, the new governor, Yanovsky, it's been horrible here. Our people cry tears of blood. I beg you, help these people understand what compassion is. And Yanovsky took Father Hermann's advice. He completely reformed the company policy. But he became so close to Father Hermann, after 2 years, he resigned as governor of Alaska and went back to Russia and became a monk. The future administrations, however, were just as merciful and kind to the native people as Yanovsky. The Baranov era was like the Stalinist era in Russia. Probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people perished. And certainly the life on Kodiak Island and the Aleutian Islands was quite miserable during the Shelikov-Baranov era. But then the government intervened. They had a 20-year monopoly. They got the monopoly only after Catherine the Great died, by the way. She had a son who couldn't stand her guts. He undid every policy she had. So if Mama was against a for monopoly for Alaska, Tsar Paul was a little bit crazy, was in favor of it. And that's how the company in 1798 got a 20-year monopoly after all. Shelikov, by the way, by that time was already dead. I believe his wife poisoned him, but that's another story. Under the second charter, which began in 1818, the company was making millions. And So the government said, we'll renew your contract, we'll renew your monopoly, but you've got to support and fund churches, schools, and hospitals. So starting in 1818, the company had to look for clergy. They were willing to build churches, but an empty church isn't going to do anybody any good. So the call went out for volunteers to come to Alaska. Your salary will be paid out of the profits of the fur company. And Yuan Bendeninoff volunteered with his wife. I don't think she knew about it until it was too late. His wife, his mother, his brother, and their two-year-old daughter left Irkutsk, the center of the fur trade, where he had gone to seminary, and came to Sitka, which is in the Green Panhandle area. It was the capital of the colony at that time. But it was the capital of the colony, and most of the people there were Aleuts. Even at the time of sale in 1867, it was over 60% Native, this capital. It was the Native Alaskans who were running the show. That's where the manpower was. In any case, he went to Sitka. He began learning Unangan. And by the time he arrived in the Aleutian chain, back out in the opposite end of Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, he was not fluent, but he was well on his way to mastering the Unangan language. Within the year, with the assistance of an Aleut chief, Ivan Pankov, he developed a writing system, an orthography, an alphabet for Unangan, and translated the Gospel of Matthew into Unangan. He then, of course, it doesn't do any good to translate the Gospel. Nobody else can read it but you. So he had to open a school. He developed a primer for teaching people to read and write in Unangan, and he did a catechism and a Bible storybook. And he sent all this to Russia, along with what he called the notes of the Unalaska district. It was the grammar of the language, it was a description of the songs and the ceremonies of this tribe. It included the precipitation, the rainfall, and the wind speed, and the temperature of every day that he'd been there for 10 years. It was an ethnographic study of the language, the customs of the Unangan region, and even a scientific, with the first weather station, basically, the first meteorological station. He analyzed and he actually brought the wood from Sitka in 1824, so that in 1825 he built the first wooden church at Holy Ascension Church at Unalaska. 10 years in the Aleutian Islands, this was the work that he undertook with a school. So that by the time Alaska became American territory, the majority of the Unangan people could read and write not only in their own language, but also in Russian. Since they were the product of the intermarriage with the Promyshleniki, many or even most of the Unangan people could also read and understand Russian. By the time Alaska became a territory, they had a higher literacy rate than European Russia. But that was the work of one man, Innocent Veniminov. After 10 years in the Aleutians, he was doing such a good job, they moved him to the Tlingit area, the green area here in southeast Alaska, where he learned the Tlingit language, devised an alphabet for Tlingit, and began translations into the Tlingit tongue, and then opened the school for Tlingit. This was after 15 years in Alaska. He finally got his printed books back from the printer. They were so filled with typographical errors, they were useless. The company at least had footed the bill for printing, but now it was crates and crates of books that no one could read because no one in St. Petersburg could proofread Unangan. So it had been 15 years, and it was time for a break. He asked the company and the church if he could go to St. Petersburg himself to supervise the publication of his own translations, both the Tlingit books and the Unangan books, so to get the schools going because the kids still had to copy everything on their slates. And he was given permission. Now, there was no Panama Canal and no Suez Canal. So Veniminov's trip to St. Petersburg, where he'd never been before, he was from the boonies, he was from Irkutsk. He sailed to Hawaii, and then to Sydney, Australia, and then to Cape Town, South Africa, then to the Canary Islands, then to Great Britain and Denmark, and finally into St. Petersburg. This trip took something like 9 months. Meanwhile, his wife and kids were going home to see grandma. Because he had 6 children by now, and 5 of them had never seen Russia. So Catherine, his wife, and the 6 kids went on a different ship to the Siberian coast. And by the time he got to St. Petersburg, word had reached the capital that his wife had died in Irkutsk. Now, his first impulse was, of course, to forget the publications and go immediately to reunite himself with his children. Fortunately, they were in his in-laws' care. And he was so famous by now, because his writings had been published in Europe, everybody wanted to meet him. The Russian scientific community wanted to meet him. They wanted to interview him about all his scientific observations and writings. The Tsar wanted to meet him. The emperor didn't have many opportunities to talk to somebody who came from the other end of his empire, where he, of course, would never go. So he was invited to the Winter Palace. And Tsar Nicholas I expressed his condolences. Sorry to hear about your wife. Father said, well, I'm planning to leave in the next few days to get to Irkutsk. Of course, her funeral had been months before. It wasn't likely to get there in time for her burial, but the six kids. And the emperor said, don't worry about the children. I'll take care of that. I'll pay their tuition to whatever schools they qualify for, but I want you to go back to Alaska as bishop. Now, of course, you know, in our tradition, that meant taking monastic vows, and he wasn't at all excited about that. He was befriended by Metropolitan Filaret of Moscow, who encouraged Father Veniaminov to go, to think about it, to at least pray about it. He made a pilgrimage to Kiev, to the Monastery of the Caves, and he returned saying, okay, let God's will be done. He was consecrated in 1842 in St. Petersburg. He at least had a horse to go. He didn't have to walk all the way to Irkutsk and then out to the Pacific. He prayed at his wife's grave. He saw his children, and he continued on to Sitka, where they were already building him a residence. The residence is still standing. It's one of the few authentic Russian-era buildings that remain in Alaska. It's a two-story structure, about as wide as this room, and of course twice as high as the second story, and maybe twice as long. But the bottom floor were classrooms and dormitory space for the new school that he envisioned. And the upstairs had a reception area, and a bedroom and an office for him, and a guest room at the other end. The second half was a chapel, because this was going to be the first Orthodox seminary in the New World. And that was founded in 1842 in New Archangel, the city we now call Sitka. And Veniaminov poured himself into building this school and creating its six-year curriculum. They didn't just train church readers, singers, and priests. They also trained navigators, accountants, seamen, cartographers, oil painters and portraitists, and musicians. Sitka had Aleuts playing Mozart in the time of Innocent Veniaminov. He was doing such a good job. They made his diocese larger. They added the Kamchatka Peninsula to it. To make his pastoral rounds through the Diocese of Alaska and Kamchatka was a voyage of 2 years. Because it's the entire North Pacific Rim. He was doing such a good job. After 4 years, they moved him to Yakutsk. Those of you who play the board game Risk might have some idea where Yakutsk is. It's like the coldest, most desolate part of Siberia, where he learned the Yakut language, devised an alphabet for it, and began the education and the transformation of Yakut culture using bilingual, the same bilingual approach he had made for the Tlingits and the Unangan Aleuts. In 1868, at the age of 71, because he was doing such a good job, he was elected Metropolitan Archbishop of Moscow. Now, he was already losing his eyesight. He had spent over 50 years in the boonies, in the Aleutian Islands, in southeast Alaska, in Siberia. He had mastered three languages. He had launched these tribes on a literary and educational academic career that lasted over a century more. At 71, he had grounds to say, pick somebody else. And that's exactly, by the way, what he does say. I have his acceptance speech because reluctantly he did make the journey to Moscow. He succeeded Filaret, whom I mentioned earlier. Metropolitan Filaret was an aristocrat who spoke like seven languages. He had several PhDs. Now look at Veniaminov with a high school diploma. And so this is how he starts his acceptance speech. It's simply extraordinary. We should hear presidential inaugural addresses like this. Who am I to dare to take up the word and authority of my predecessor? A mere student from bygone days and far-off places, who spent over half his life in a country still further off, no more than a humble worker in one of Christ's small vineyards, a teacher of children and babes in the faith. How can I, the least of all workers, work in this great and glorious ancient vineyard of Christ, Moscow? How can a teacher such as I instruct a flock from whose midst teachers and guides, indeed teachers of teachers, have gone forth to all parts of Russia? True, I could say these things almost anywhere I might be sent, but here, there is something quite particular. Look at whom I must follow. Who was my predecessor, and then who am I? There can be no comparison, or rather, any comparison might always be drawn would be far from favorable to me, and would in fact be rather against me. I understood the full difficulty, the bitterness of such comparisons wholly natural, unavoidable, and fair. I understood, too, how fully sublime and difficult it would be to minister here, and I ought to have, or at least I could have, shirked it, having indeed reasons for doing so. But who am I to oppose God, the heavenly King, without whose will not a hair falls from our heads? No, I said to myself, let it be with me as the Lord wills. I will go where I'm told. And so I've come. O Lord, bless me to begin my work. Lord, I'm yours and wish to be yours everywhere and always. Do with me as you will in this life and in the world to come. May I be a tool in your hands. Then he turns to the faculty. First to the tombs of the hierarchs who were there, because he's in the Dormition Cathedral. So he turns to... O hierarchs of Christ, Peter, Alexis, Jonah, and Philip, and all of you who lie here asleep in the Lord, accept me in your prayers, your most unworthy successor. Now the faculty, brothers and fathers, especially you learned instructors and fathers, you do not deserve an illiterate leader like me. But bear with me for the love of Christ, and accept me in your daily prayers. Pray even more that false teaching and human philosophizing and error not creep into our faith through my illiteracy. I ask you all, brothers and children, to pray for me, a sinner. What strikes me, and I'm sure strikes you, is that this man is a genius. He built churches. He designed St. Michael's Cathedral. If you ever go to Sitka, you have to walk through there. He built the clock in the clock tower himself. He learned Klinger. He learned Aleut. As we've already discussed, he launched the missions under impossible circumstances. And then he comes to Moscow and says, pray for me. You don't deserve as someone as stupid as me to be your bishop. But the next month, he begins his work in earnest. He founds the Orthodox Mission Society. We would expect that with someone from his background. He calls the businessmen, of course, together. The people with some extra money. And they all bring their checkbooks, of course. And he says to them, first of all, forget the money. We have other things to talk about first. Okay. He says, you know, I've been a missionary all my life. And it's a mystery to me why anybody converts or doesn't convert. I know everyone will say that you need the right people, with the right equipment, with the right material, with the right training. And if everything in any enterprise, not just ours, if everything is just right, you got the right people, with the right supplies, with the right training, with the right background, you might have some hope of success. But when it comes to spreading the gospel, basically these things don't apply. And I'll tell you why. It's a mystery to God who comes to faith and who doesn't. And I don't even have to mention to you the holy apostles who preached, and some people accepted the gospel as they preached it, and others turned away. I can cite to you our Lord Jesus Christ, who was the very truth itself. And there were people who saw him even performing miracles and refused to believe. So what then is our situation? What should we do? He says, before we start collecting money and printing pamphlets or training missionaries, we need to pray. We need to pray for, and he has a list. First and foremost, we must pray. If in even everyday matters, people fall back upon prayer, asking God's blessing at the beginning of some task, and then throughout asking for renewal and strength. Here, in the matter of conversion, prayer is the very means itself, and the most effectual means. For without prayer, we cannot expect success. Therefore, first of all, we should pray that the Lord will send workers into his harvest. Second, that he will open the hearts of those who listen to the word of the gospel. Third, that he will increase our society's numbers more and more. And finally, that he will strengthen and confirm in us the desire we all now feel to further this holy work. Pray first. And if you're all ready to make that commitment to pray, as I've outlined, I'm ready to take those donations. And that mission society supported the mission in Alaska for the next 50 years, from 1868 when it was founded till 1918 when the Soviet government seized its bank accounts. You can hardly go anywhere in Alaska today where there's not a candle stand, sometimes a whole iconostas, candle, lampadas, censers, gospel books, chalices that weren't in fact sent to North America. They didn't even know where it was going to go. Sent to North America from this mission society. So what do we learn from St. Herman and St. Innocent? To recap. From St. Herman we learn that you have to have a sincere and deep prayer life. Because people recognized him as a holy person. They had all those awful people exploiting and enslaving and oppressing them. But they had one sincere, honest, committed, loving, Orthodox Christian, and they could look to him and say, that's the kind of person I want to be. As St. Seraphim of Sarov says, save yourself and 1,000 others will be saved. The Albanian people came to St. Herman's grave every year and often to pray. We venerate him as a miracle worker, but he didn't perform any miracles during his life. There's not a single miracle of healing attributed to Father Herman while he was alive on earth. All the miracles of healing occurred when people prayed in his tomb. They're all posthumous. People came to the spring that flows from the ground near his burial site, and people took, Aleutic people took earth from his grave and anointed themselves with it, and for hundreds of years now they have been miraculously healed of their afflictions. But it happened posthumously. It happened after his death. They were coming there because they recognized that here was at least one truly committed and pious, loving, believing, Orthodox man. A real Christian. And they held him up to their children as an ideal. And from him flowed these miracles that confirmed them in their faith. So never underestimate the power of just saying your prayers and doing the best you can. Because that's really all Father Herman did. And everything else was in God's hands. There will be no mission if people aren't living up as best they can to their message. Living the faith. Practicing what you preach. And what we learn from St. Innocent is people have to understand their faith. They have to be able to grasp it, to understand it. What they haven't experienced, but someone has to explain it to them. Having the experience by itself isn't enough. St. Innocent says, the experience by itself will soon grow cold unless it can be nurtured with knowledge and study. And that's why he founded all those schools. So it's the same for us. We need the experience, but we also need to understand it. Without the experience, it's just words. I was discussing this just yesterday down in Colombia with a professor of neurosurgery, a real scientist. But he was saying, you know, people today think that science has the monopoly on truth. And I bring my students just so far, and then I say, what does it mean to be a human being? And, you know, you can analyze all the bones and all the various systems, digestive and circulatory and the rest in your body. Is a human being just that, or is there something more? And he goes into, he said, you know what I tell them? The word love means nothing unless you've been loved and experienced love. Otherwise, it has no meaning. Poets and troubadours and musicians have tried to put it into words, put it into music, put it into poetry for thousands of years. No one can finally say they finally got it. You know, all these attempts are just attempts. You can't, you have to experience it first, and then you realize that you can't put it into words. But the word itself remains empty if you don't have the experience. So the experience is primary. But then you have to be able to articulate it and share it. And that's what we learn from St. Hermann and St. Innocent. Finally, we only have time for one more saint. Well, I've got a few more, but we only have so much time. There's St. Jakob de Zwietof, who was a colleague of St. Innocent. He went to the same seminary. He was a couple classes behind. He was allied. He was from St. George Island, a tiny speck of a volcanic island in the middle of the Bering Sea. His father was Russian. His mother was Unanga. He went to the seminary. He married a Russian lady. He brought his Russian bride to Atka, which is in the middle of the Aleutian chain. And he had responsibility for the Aleutian Islands all the way to Japan. Now, to get there, he had to kayak. Fortunately, he was Unangan and knew how to do that. His church was a tent. So wherever he stopped, he put up his tent and called the people to worship. These were Unangan people. They were already Christian, but they didn't have churches. There was no wood. So for 20 years, he paddled from village to village to village and back again. After 12 years, his wife got sick. They sent her to the hospital in Sitka, where she died. Within months of her death, his house burned down. He survived 8 more years and then petitioned on the 20th anniversary of his ordination for retirement. His bishop by this time was Innocent Beniaminov. Bishop Innocent said, "Of course, Father Yakov, you can retire as soon as I find a replacement." And he did retire 18 years later. And he spent those 18 years not among his own people, the Unangan in the Aleutian chain, but in that blue area I showed you earlier. He was assigned to the Yupik Eskimos, the people who had killed Yuvanali 50 years earlier. And there he learned Yupik, and he devised a writing system for the Yupik language, and he began translating the Holy Scriptures and the services of the church into Yupik. He spent 18 years traveling down the Yukon, around the Bering Sea, and up the Kuskokwim, Alaska's second largest river. And he comes to Quinnahock and writes in his journal, "This is where Father Yuvanali was killed." He's the first one to testify to that. In any case, my favorite episode with Father Yakov, although there are many, involves about 1853, a delegation of Athabascan Indians from the interior coming down the Yukon River and basically shanghaiing him. "You're coming with us and no excuses. You keep telling us you're going to come up and visit us, but you never come." Of course, it wasn't his assignment to evangelize the Athabascans. He was under no authority to do that. But they were tired of waiting. So they put him in a boat and they paddled 4 days up the Yukon River. And then he says, this is in May of 1853, they put him in a little hut and he sat there all day. And then he says, "Toward evening they summoned me and I came out to the riverbank and discovered that the entire river was covered with boats, over 100 vessels, kayaks, canoes, and one Vigar, a sailboat with a sail. And all of these people were converging at their own initiative to hear him preach." Fortunately, there were enough Prabhushleniki who had intermarried with these people to serve as his interpreters. And for 4 days he preached. He started with Genesis and he ended with Pentecost. At the end of this marathon preaching, they unanimously and without further discussion requested to be baptized. So he divided them into three groups and spent the next day baptizing the adult males. He spent the next day baptizing the adult females. He spent the third day baptizing the teenagers and the younger children. And at the end of this week, he records in his journal, he says, "From this activity, I became dreadfully tired." And then he says, and it's the only time in almost 40 years of reports, he says, "But the sight of so many people gathered together, worshiping the true God, the joy of this alleviates all my bodily aches and pains." And so the next day he celebrates liturgy. And it's only here that you get the full import of what he has just done. He says on this final day, imagine my joy seeing these people of different tribes, former enemies, now united in Christ. I know it's, especially in academic circles where I work most of the time, Christian missionaries get a bad press. It's like we've come in and messed up these people. Like, if we had just left them alone, they would have been just fine. In my experience, that's probably not true, in fact. These people were fighting each other and killing each other and capturing each other and enslaving each other for thousands of years. You remember the Aleut guy from Kodiak who had been captured by the Unangan and had to be ransomed by Chilikov? That was typical. We're the human beings. Therefore, those people aren't. And if they're not really human beings, you can do whatever you want with them. If too many of them come across the river, kill them. If there's only a few of them, capture them and enslave them. That's the origin of human slavery everywhere. They're not really human beings. If we're the human beings and they're different from us, then by definition, they can't be really human. They're imposters. As my wife's people would say, they're wannabes. Because the word Yupik means a real people. Now here are Athabascan tribes who've been fighting each other probably for generations, if not centuries, and this little Aleut guy from Apka gets shanghaied and hauled up the river, and he preaches to them for 4 days, and it's the end of those wars. Why? Every tribe has figured out, I think, it's just logical, what we would call the Ten Commandments. We don't have to come there to tell them not to kill each other, not to steal from each other, not to swipe each other's wives or swap them. We don't have to tell them not to lie, because people can't live together in a community if people are murdering and stealing and lying and deceiving each other. So most tribal peoples have figured that out one way or the other. So what does Christianity have to offer? What's our contribution? Exactly what Yakov Ben Sviatov did those days in May of 1853. He told them something they could have never figured out on their own, because it's totally illogical. Love your enemy. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who abuse you. Forgive one another as I have forgiven you. That's news. The way I understand it, tribal peoples all over the world, certainly in Alaska, it's as if they figured out certain things. Like they're putting together this jigsaw puzzle, and they have more than half the pieces. But the critical pieces right in the middle are missing. So they can't quite discern what the picture is. And the missionary comes and tells them, as Paul Harvey might have said, the rest of the story. He fills in those missing pieces, and they get it. And the image is Christ. And they could have never figured that out, because nobody ever figured it out. There were all those prophecies that the Jewish faith had, and they still couldn't figure it out. Even when Jesus Christ told them what was going to happen, they still didn't get it. He comes back even after his resurrection and scolds them. What's the matter with you guys? Huh? People can hardly believe the picture they get, the story they get. The missionary comes and says, this is what you've been missing. He doesn't say, scrap that puzzle, throw those pieces overboard, I'm going to start a new picture. He says, I've got the pieces you couldn't find and could have never guessed. And so when he tells those stories for those 3 or 4 days, they understand. It fits. And they accept the message. And they stop fighting. He tells us what he preached about that liturgy at the seventh day of his mission. I preached about this, but mostly he says, I preached about the peaceful coexistence between all people. That they should live in peace and brotherhood. And then he gets in his boat and makes it all the way back in one day. Now, Yakov Ben Sviatov was sick almost his entire mission on the Yukon. 18 years, and he was bedridden, I bet about half the time. How do we know this? Clergy in Alaska, and I think probably everywhere in Siberia, were required by their bishop to keep a daily journal. Not a dear diary, I'm feeling depressed. Not like that. It's rather routine. Today I had church school, 12 children. Today I chrismated an infant. Tomorrow I'm having a funeral for the lady who died last week. I mean, it's that kind of stuff. It's pretty routine. But that's how we know this daily account of what I just told you. There are some extraordinary sections. And I've taken from 40 years of St. Jakob's career, 20 years in the Aleutian Islands, and 18 in the Yukon Delta. I've taken the highlights of that and put them into my first book years ago, 20 years ago. It's out of print now, sorry. By the way, St. Vladimir's has the copyright, and if you want to read this stuff, you have to write to Ted Basil. Because they have the right to publish this, and they've been sitting on it for a couple of years. But it's St. Jakob's journals. And when you read his journals, which we have because he had to keep a daily record of what he did. The 20 years of the Aleutian career, we had already. It was in a vault in Sitka. But the Yukon years were completely missing until we stumbled upon it in the attic of the Russian Mission Church about 15 years ago. It was like striking gold, because it's the story I just told you, for example, is among that. Now, at the end of each year, and sometimes he made several copies, his calligraphy, his writing was just perfect. This is like a printed page. St. Jakob was a very patient man with great talent. Anyway, at the end of each year, that journal, sometimes a copy of it, sometimes the second or third copy of it, because for some years, for some reason, we have several copies of the same year's journal. Anyway, it had to be bound with ribbon, sealed with a wax seal, and stamped with a double-headed eagle, and sent to the bishop in Sitka. So because of this, we have pretty much all 38 years of his career. There's one section I have to mention to you because it's just so delightful. He's on the Yukon, and the village is running out of food. Now, he has two subdeacons, Konstantin and Ivan Lukin. One of them, their father, Lukin, was a Russian, but he had a Yupik wife who died, and he remarried and had an Athabaskan wife. So he had one son who was half Russian, half Athabaskan, and another son who was half Russian, half Yupik. And these men were assigned to Father Netsvetov, who had no family, no matushka, no children, as his helpers. He sends Konstantin Lukin out hunting because there's no food in the village. It's early March, 1855, 56, 57, somewhere, the date's not significant. And it's cold, and the river is still frozen solid, and the ice is so thick they can't really fish efficiently through it. And there's no food left in the village from the previous salmon season. The smoked salmon, the supply has been exhausted. So he writes in his journal, just one line, food supply very low, I'm sending Konstantin out hunting. Second day I had a baptism, this and that, and also food supply dangerously short, no sign of Konstantin. Third day, no sign of Konstantin, nothing to eat. Fourth day, situation becoming desperate, people in this village are going hungry. Fifth day, we're in danger of starvation now, there's nothing to eat in this village and no one has a shred of food. Sixth day, thanks be to God, Konstantin has returned with five caribou, we have enough food now to tide us over till spring. Now, of course, this is all bound and stamped and sent to Sitka, where Bishop Peter, the new bishop after Veniaminov, who was an old school teacher apparently, was reading through the journals of his priests out in the boonies, out in the bush, where he's never been, of course. He's from St. Petersburg, and now he's sitting in Veniaminov's apartment upstairs. I can picture him there in the office, reading through at his leisure these journals. And he's writing little comments in the margin like a school teacher might. So he comes, this is what's so much fun, because you get not only what Netsvetov wrote, you get the bishop's response to it. And you come to this section, we're running out of food, and the bishop writes, Bozhemoy. Oh my God. And you come further down, and there's no food, and you're supposed to be a And then you come to this, thanks be to God, that Konstantin has come back with five caribou. And the bishop writes in the margin, Mnyasa chiris postu, me during then. Toward the end of his life, the last years of his life, Father Nitzvinter was finally granted that belated retirement he had requested 18 years earlier. He went to Sitka and became the pastor of the Klinkin parish there, and he found his wife's grave. You remember she had died years earlier, more than 20, and he puts a monument to her on the grave. It's quite touching. they're still there. You can find it in the cemetery. It says, here lies Anna Semyonova Netsvetova, wife of archpriest Yaakov Netsvetov, who was born in Russia and her birthday, and who fell asleep in the Lord on the day of her death. And at this place awaits the resurrection of the last day. Then he died, and nobody knows where they buried him. Like Mozart, you know, it's one of those tragedies. We have a memorial to Father Yaakov in the cemetery where somewhere in there he's buried, but we really don't know where his relics are. But people have, because we discovered his diaries, his journals, people have read his story and said, if he's not a priest, there's no hope for the rest of us. He's in that tent. Even on the Yukon, he still had that tent. He's serving services at 20 below zero. He's amazed that the people show up for Pascha, standing on frozen ground. He's bedridden for weeks at a time. But no matter how sick he is, when Holy Week comes, he drags himself out of bed and forces himself to celebrate the Holy Week and Paschal services. And every year, he's renewed. Every year, Pascha gives him the strength to carry on for one more year. And it's clear, because he writes on this bright and glorious holy day of the resurrection of our Lord. I mean, that's the kind of thing he writes every Pascha, year after year after year. What do you have to learn from St. Yaakov? Well, for two things, I think. One is, don't complain. When your mail is slow, remember he who got mail once a year and had to go 200 miles to fetch it. And there were times when he was hauling his annual supplies as well as his mail home. I mean, he had to get his flour and his tea and his sugar and all his ecclesial supplies from St. Michael's 100 miles, not only out the river, but out in the Bering Sea. And then he had to paddle it home. Of course, he had those two subdeacons to help, but that wasn't, you know, it was still tough. And some years, the river froze before he got home, so he had to unload his boat, stash his supplies, send word home to get dog teams, and haul his supplies the rest of the way. And this is a man probably with acute arthritis, because it's his legs that keep him in bed. And when you say the church was a little bit drafty today, think of St. Yaakov in his tent at 20 below zero. Where the people stood motionless with their Paschal candles and sang all night anyway. See, when you need a Tylenol, think of him who had no aspirin. The second thing I think we need to remember about St. Yaakov, what St. Yaakov has to say to us is, it's Pascha that matters. In a sense, the church exists because of the resurrection. Without the resurrection, there'd be no Pascha. The apostles would still be locked in that upper room, shaking in their sandals. The resurrection transformed them from cowardly disciples of a slain teacher to heroic preachers of the gospel, willing to be martyred rather than not preach. The resurrection made all the difference. Why are we Orthodox Christians? We don't talk about this very often. I think we should, though. I think we all have this experience during Holy Week, and especially at Pascha. Fortunately, it doesn't happen to all of us simultaneously. There are those moments when the reality of this hits, right? Not just in your head, but through your whole being. And in those moments, you can't talk. You know what I'm talking about? You are overwhelmed by Paschal joy. That's what we expect every Holy Week, isn't it? That's what we want every Pascha. And as I'm saying, it doesn't happen to everybody all at once, because if it happened to everybody all at once, the whole church would be quiet. Somebody has to keep it going. Huh? And you know, I must confess to you, for us clergy, for us standing at the altar, it's especially tough, because we would like to bask in that joy for a minute. But we don't dare, because, again, the whole service would stop if we lingered there too long. But that's it, isn't it? It's not just that you've heard the gospel preached and you understand it intellectually. It's not just an emotion that we've deliberately, what would you say, incited, because we've done nothing to excite our emotions. Everything is done rather according to the rubrics, huh? By the rule. And yet, at sometimes at completely unexpected moments, and it's, for me, different every year, it's never the same time twice, we are simply overwhelmed by that joy. And it proves that everything we've been taught, everything we've ever studied, everything we've learned, everything we've accepted intellectually is true, and it's true to in a way that overwhelms us. And I remember having that experience my first Pascha at St. Vladimir's. And thinking to myself as I reflected on it, the only sadness on Pascha is to realize there are those who never have known that joy. And that's the cause and the inspiration, the foundation and the basis for our mission. It's Pascha. When St. Yaakov was canonized, they had an icon of him painted in his white paschal vestments. Because for me, that little alley preacher out there in the boonies, where nobody would have known if he stayed in bed that week or not, he was really too sick. He could have made perfect excuse. I couldn't do it this year. I was too sick. I was too weak. My legs gave out. But every year he's there in that tent, celebrating and bursting into paschal joy, year after year after year. So if there's anything to be gained from St. Yaakov, about whom we probably know the least, I mean, St. Herman's been around for 35, 40 years. Everybody knows about St. Herman. St. Denison, Metropolitan of Moscow. You go to Holy Trinity St. Serge's Monastery. He's in a gilded reliquary. When you're in Alaska, they open the reliquary so you can venerate him directly. They welcome us very warmly there. He's ours and he's theirs. St. Yaakov, we don't even know where he's been. That's sort of a tragedy for me. And yet, it seems to me, we've got to keep his memory alive. First of all, because, like I said, he's not a saint. The rest of us parish priests don't have a chance at all. But more importantly, because he reminds us at the core of our mission, as the inspiration for doing it at all, and also the goal of our mission, the whole point of it is the resurrection, the Pascha, the holy Pascha, from death to life and from earth to heaven, which I believe we as Orthodox Christians, I don't mean to boast or, you know, we're better at it, we're just given through the church, not through our own worthiness. Despite our sinfulness, we're given the gift of that joy. And it's that joy that must be the inspiration as well as the goal of our mission. And although St. Herman doesn't write about that, I'm sure it was true for him even when he was alone in his hut on Spruce Island. And I'm sure that that's what propelled and inspired St. Innocent. But we're positive that that was at the core of St. Yaakov's very being. And the only reason St. Eulenale wanted to get close to those Yupik hunters to preach to them. Otherwise, you see all those arrows pointed at you, and you turn around and go back the other way. Are you crazy? I have one last story about him, and we'll conclude with it. I have a nephew who married a Moravian Protestant woman in the village of Quinahock, where St. Eulenale was killed. And I said to him, Michael, keep your ears open, just in case anybody in this village wants to tell the story of how the first priest who came there was martyred. And sure enough, within a year, he reported back. I heard the story. I said, what was it like? He said, exactly the way you wrote it down in the magazine, exactly the way Grandpa used to tell it, except for one thing. What was that? He said, the way I heard it in our village, from an elder there, there was one detail that no one else included before. What was that? He said, well, the story is, the way he told it, just before the priest in the boat was about to be killed, because you could clearly see the archers on the shore with their bows drawn, just before he died, and this perplexed those Yupik men on the shore, just before they released their arrows, it looked to them like the priest in the boat was trying to chase away flies. What was Father Eulenale doing? And I don't think he was just praying for himself. I think he was blessing those who were about to kill him. That's the fulfillment of the gospel. To bless those who curse you, to forgive those who wound you,
to love your enemies. It's the epitome of the martyr. And he was probably doing it very fast. Which means 200 years later, it's still remembered as trying to chase away the followers. Isn't that a believable detail? They didn't just make that up last week. It proves to us St. Juvenali did. He died, and where he died, but he died trying to bring paschal joy to those people. So finally, just last week I was discussing this with the dean of that deanery. They're starting a new mission up north of the Kuskokwim River in a small village where there are also many people who have intermarried with Moravians, but there are enough Orthodox people there that they want to build a church. So this spring, our diocese at least is going to collect money so they can get the, there's no wood out there, to get the building supplies to build the church of the village of Kipnuk amid the Moravian majority. And we've already decided, I think, to name that church St. Cyril and Methodius. Because Cyril and Methodius evangelized Moravia. But then, I'm hoping we can launch a national campaign, because enough Orthodox Christians have intermarried or moved to the village of Quinahock. And you already know what we'll name that church. And isn't it important for us, after all these years, to finally have a St. Juvenali and his companion church at the site of his martyrdom. Final story, final message. I hope you would come up and visit and see these places I've talked about. I think I mentioned that, I remember now where. I have this Greek friend from Athens who visited us some 20 years ago. And we took two steps. I took him to Spruce Island, and we took two steps down the path going to Father Herman's original burial site, which is almost a mile down the path in the woods. He just took two steps down that path, and he stopped. And it was a surprising thing he said at this point. I wasn't expecting it at all. Two steps down the path, and he exclaimed, "Your church can be autocephalous." We weren't discussing autocephaly at the time. What was he saying? I said, "What do you mean, Father George?" He said, "Well, you know, I live in Athens, and from afar, we say, well, those Americans, those Orthodox in America, they have seminaries, they have monasteries, they have bishops, they have priests. They have everything you need to be an autocephalous, an independent, a self-governing church, except, in my opinion," he said, "except for one thing, holiness. They don't have a holy land like we have on Mount Athos. They don't have a holy place like we have in the Middle East, at the St. George Monastery, for example, in the desert. They don't have a St. Catherine's Monastery like we have on Mount Sinai. They don't have the Tomb of the Lord. They don't even have a Holy Trinity St. Sergius Monastery like they have in Moscow, or the Monastery of the Caves like they have in Kiev. They have no sense of holiness. So I've been opposed to your independence, your self-governing status, because until you have that, you really can't be an independent, self-governing Orthodox Church. I've taken two steps into these woods, and I realize you have it. It's here. You have a holy land." And then he said something really extraordinary, guys. I remember after all these years. He said, "You know, the sense of holiness here in this forest is more intense than any place I've ever experienced it, except for one sight." I said, "Where was that, Father George?" He said, "At the Tomb of the Lord." So we're talking about this, I remember now, Father at lunch, and he said, "You know, if you're Muslim and you make the pilgrimage to Mecca, you get to add Haji to your name, the one who made the Hajj, the one who made the pilgrimage. So we have to propose that anyone who makes the pilgrimage to Spruce Island can add something to their name." The idea came up at lunch. We think Hermani would be a good... Hermani. Instead of Haji, the one who did the Hajj, the one who came to Father Herman. And you can sign your name, but that is one of your middle names then from that point on. Because we have a holy land. And if there's any doubt in people's mind that real holiness can sanctify not just a person, but a place, as Philip said to Nathaniel, "Come and see." That's our missionary invitation to everyone. If you have doubts, come and see. I very seldom recommend, and I have mixed feelings about inviting people to Pascha. It's kind of overwhelming, and they're usually too tired.
But you really have to be up for it.
But bring them to Holy Friday Vespers.
And have them experience what the death of the Lord means. And then if there's still interested, try Holy Saturday. So, but you know, Pascha is unique in our culture. We have 40 days to get ready for it for a reason. All these holy calisthenics we do are for a reason. So we won't be tired on Pascha night because we've already done how many prostrations during Great Lent, so that the night goes by quickly. And we wish we could do it again for several days in a row. We can't get enough of it. We do it for the Crown Bright Week for the whole week, and then we do it for 40 days more. But you have to be ready for it. So some people say, well, I brought my fiancé or I brought my best friend to Pascha. But you know, they didn't get it. Well, of course, because they weren't prepared as we're trying to prepare during Great Lent. That's really what Lent is about. It's about getting ready for Pascha. But in a certain sense, our whole life is about getting ready for Pascha. And the ultimate Pascha, the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come, which we believe we have seen with our eyes and heard with our ears and touched with our hands. And if you don't believe it, come and see. That's our mission. Our mission, your mission, every Orthodox parish's mission. Because our only sadness on Pascha is that there are those who don't know that joy. And it's not because we want to impose our beliefs on anybody. It's not because we just need more members for our parish, for their donations or their membership. It's because we just can't bear the thought of others not knowing the joy that we have in the resurrection of Christ. That's our mission. So come and see Alaska, and then here in your town, invite anyone who's at all searching to come and see, because you have it here. It's not because you're a better Christian than they are. It's not because you're smarter or more better educated or well-versed. It's not the materials. It's not the preacher. It's what St. Vincent said back in 1868. It's up to God who will be converted. Pray for them. But in the meantime, our mission is to invite others to come and see. God bless you.
Part two of this, in a sense, is going to be at Furman University at 4:30 on Tuesday afternoon. Father Michael is going to speak, if I'm understanding it correctly, basically the collision of this Russian-Alaska